Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric and Matt, and this is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit, your beacon of freedom and the American way of life. Tune in every Friday for a new episode as we dive into the world of liberty and what makes our country great. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of LLP. I'm Eric, and this is Matt.
Hello.
And I hope everybody's had a great week. Whew.
It's things been are a crazy. Doozy. Oh, yeah, man. It's been a doozy.
Yeah. Things are crazy in the world of liberty. And we want to articulate and talk about a few things in today's podcast. So I hope you'll stick around. Make sure that you give us a great review on all the various podcast forums that are out there. There's plenty of places you can find us. Also, if you're over on YouTube here, we do have this podcast release in video form each week over on Iraq Veteran 8888 if you want to check it out. So this week we're going to be discussing, the title of today's podcast is ATF, Brace for Impact.
Brace for Impact.
Now, what do you think that might have to do with?
I don't know. Braces?
Yeah. So, you know, there's been a lot of conjecture and a lot of different ideas that have been kind of floating around about how this brace thing could go. All right. And right now, unfortunately, it's a lot of speculation. I mean, and some of it is backed up by things such as this worksheet that they put out that assigns a point system and a criteria system for identifying, let's just say, pistols as NFA items or not NFA items. There's been a lot of thought out there as to how they're going to approach the brace situation. You guys might remember here sometime back, there was a comment period that was open where people could submit their comments to the ATF on the brace situation.
Correct.
So the overall idea is, I think around August, they're going to be releasing a decision that they've come to based on the amount of commentary that they got in. They supposed to have went through these comments and then made some sort of arbitrary decision based on what those, you know, what the commentary is, and I guess their own arbitrary and, you know, arbitrary rulemaking that they have on their end, which we're going to get into that a bit, but
yeah, it's just weird. It's just however they want to interpret those results. And that's, I think that's one of the issues that, you know, us as, you know, as gun owners, we see the flaw in the system is that they become the arbiter of the results. So if you go out there and you put on those online, you know, comments, which, by the way, guys, I'm very surprised that we didn't get more than we did. I think it was a pretty low number versus how many actual gun owners there are. So it lets me know when I see those numbers. You know, and a lot of content creators will keep up with it. I know Jared over at Guns and Gadgets was doing a great job of, you know, putting out those numbers daily of like what those comments were. You know, Mike over at Guns and Gear, he also keeps up with a great amount of, you know, those daily doses of information drops when the comment period is open. And I saw those comment numbers and I thought to myself, you know, there's, you know, a couple hundred million guns in America, millions of gun owners in America, but we don't even have a quarter million comments in the comments section. So hopefully they're able to interpret those comments and come out with a favorable interpretation of what that would be.
Well, how often has, let's just say, a government entity ever really truly responded to, let's just say, massive discourse in regards to a negative connotation, what they're trying to accomplish on the, let's just say, the front of this. Now, that's where this stuff kind of gets sticky, right? So I'm going to look at this worksheet and sort of articulate a few points that I want to kind of discuss. But the weird thing about it is, so what the ATF has essentially sort of done in this last couple of decades, especially the last 10 years, is they have become this sort of de facto enforcement agency that also somehow is able to articulate laws or have, let's just say, for instance, Trump's bump stock ban, right? For, let's just say, the president to say, all right, I'm going to issue an executive order and say, okay, now I want these to be treated as such. But that doesn't go through the lawmaking process, right? Only Congress can pass laws. Only Congress can change laws or amend laws, right? So there's a legislative process that we have in place that is, you know, ensures our checks and balances.
That's right.
And allows us to properly and with the consent and input of the people pass or amend or change or outright do away with laws, right? I mean, that's the general idea. There are so many gun laws on the books and there's so much crazy stuff. But what we do have is a very distinctive definition for what a pistol is. Okay. And I know that we get into, let's say, common use, for instance, right? And that's a term that gets thrown around a lot. Like, hey, this item is in common use. And then let's say arbitrary decisions such as the way they're going to approach something from a standpoint of legality or the way that they're going to write a law such as the GCA or, you know, the NFA and what they're going to consider an NFA item. Let's say based on, oh, well, this rule change, we're going to make this based on this common use factor or whether or not it's going to affect X amount of people in such and such way, right? Kind of this arbitrary man behind the curtain, hidden levers of power, like Wizard of Oz type scenario, where it's just a guy behind the curtain pulling levers and whatever spits out on the end of the machine, you just got to deal with and, you know, whatever. So it seems that there's this super arbitrary and somewhat unpaved road that they're trying to go down. And they're trying to, let's just say, they're trying to blaze a trail that's not there yet, but is not built on concrete lawmaking practices through Congress, right? Mm-hmm. So what they're essentially trying to do is redefine what a pistol is without changing the law. And that's what's so troublesome about the worksheet. At the beginning of the worksheet, they more or less kind of say that, well, the ATF doesn't really, you know, we don't regulate accessories. We only regulate the complete firearm in its totality. But wait a minute. When you used, all right, when Trump used executive fiat to go after bump stocks, what did they do? But yeah, exactly that. Accessory. They used their power or whatever, or at least what is the, you know, what they view as their power, like what they think is really their power and isn't, to say, oh, well, this device is simply a machine gun, but that's not true. An accessory. It's an accessory. So they're going to say in this worksheet, well, you know, we view it as a complete gun and not as an accessory. The ATF does not regulate accessories, but, well, yeah, they totally do, because they're using this worksheet as a vehicle, if you will, to essentially go after braces, and they've already gone after bump stocks. Now, granted, that's all still in court, but see how arbitrary that all is? It's very draconian. It's a very odd way of doing things, and it's not only is it not really constitutionally valid, obviously, but it's just not bound in the lawmaking process. I mean, we're a nation of laws, we're a nation of checks and balances, and if we're going to exist on that plane, and if that's how we're going to work as a country, and that's how we're going to agree to that, that's how we do things, well, then that's what needs to happen. Now, the ATF doesn't have the power to go, well, we're just going to scratch this line out here in the GCA, and we're going to go, all right, well, this is the definition of a handgun. Now, we're going to get a little bit more into the common use thing, because I got some arguments I'm going to want to make here. But, I mean, it's kind of weird, isn't it, when you look at that?
It is, and I think it has to do with the way that the entire agency is run. So you have the confirmation hearings and like the way that like the directors are employed. They're, at a traditional business, you move up the ladder based on your merits. I feel like when you look at all of the ATF like nominees and like the confirmation, it's all politics. It's like who aligns more with our morals versus who's going to uphold the letter of the law. And I think
the Constitution.
and I think that, you know, when we saw what happened with David Shipman was a really big, you know, eye-opening thing, because you had the senators during the confirmation asking him, well, what's the definition of a, quote, assault rifle? Like, what is it? Just tell me. Like, we can ban them, but we have to have a formal definition of what it is. And the formal definition was clearly a Ruger 10/22 with a 20-round detachable box magazine.
Yeah.
And so
He couldn't articulate it.
Well, it's not that he couldn't articulate it, but the definition doesn't exist because it's a made-up term. So, right. you're trying to nominate someone to be in a position to run the ATF that, one, can't articulate what it is and can't actually define what it is that they're trying to legislate, yeah. Which leads to the second problem. They are in a position where they can talk out of both sides of their mouth. In that same hearing, he said, well, our job isn't to define what it is. Our job is to uphold what the law is. So
is it?
Yeah. So in that one, and I think it was either Tom Cotton or Cruz that was asking him about this. And that one thing is probably what sank his opportunity to be. I mean, other than the whole like racial divide with the testing and stuff like that that he experienced.
Yeah. And was very real. Like that was something that was articulated.
That part was articulated very well. But the part where he can't define it, he can't articulate it, yet he's very quick to judge and quick to take away from the American public. That's when the comments section went on fire. Like if you went to the ATF website, I mean, that's when you saw the bulk of those comments coming in like, nah, bro, this is not going to work.
I think that it is quite concerning when a position such as, we'll talk about the director of the ATF just as a job, right? Like, that's a pretty important job. And it would seem to me that, well, actually, if you want to get technical, it's a job that shouldn't exist. The ATF shouldn't exist. But let's just say from the standpoint of, all right, would you want that job to go to a politician, or would you want that job, if you had a choice, would you want that job to go to someone who is going to be able to go, all right, look, I may not necessarily agree with everything the ATF does. I may not necessarily agree with the way the laws are, but you know what? We're going to uphold the Constitution first, right? And we're going to, you know, not that if that were the case, the NFA wouldn't exist, right?
Correct.
At all. So this whole argument, the basis for which this whole argument is supposed to hold water of, all right, this complicated and weird arbitrary worksheet that determines whether or not something that is a pistol under the law is actually, oh, well, it's not a pistol, it's a rifle based on whatever criteria you're going to try to come up with. You're going to basically try to find a workaround to decide that something is something it isn't. And you can't do that. You have to change the law to do that. So they're trying to come up with these arbitrary worksheets and arbitrary workarounds that have the weight of law, right? You can go to jail for 10 years. You can get arrested. You can get $100,000 fine, the whole kit and caboodle, right? So they want it to carry the weight of law and the consequence of breaking the law, but without going through the legal system. And there's some oddities with that, right? So, I mean, like, at one point, the ATF was under the IRS.
Yes.
Right? And then they went over to the DOJ, right? They got changed over to who they were under. Now they're under the DOJ. So did the mission change? What was the mission under the IRS? Was it the same mission?
It was to collect $200 tax stamps.
Well,
that was their job. That was their job under the IRS.
Is the mission different because they're under the DOJ?
Yeah,
now I mean, that's the question. Like, has their mission changed? And what is that mission? Right now, a $200 tax stamp is a tax. It literally says it. Like, if you've ever looked at a tax stamp, when you pay a $200 tax stamp, it is a tax. It says tax stamp.
Yeah, like, it is an actual stamp that you get.
It is literally a stamp. Yep. Okay. So you mean to tell me, now, look, guys, now I may not be the smartest person in the world, right? All right, but I know enough to know, right, that if you tell me, for instance, now I know some of you that are just listening on the podcast, you don't see what I'm holding, but some of you on YouTube are going to see that I'm holding this M4 right here. So you mean to tell me that this M4 with a regular stock and a 12.5-inch barrel, now this one happens to be a machine gun, but let's not quite worry about that. Let's just say under the guise of what we're trying to discuss with the brace kerfuffle that is currently in our face right now, right? You mean to tell me that y'all came up with this really random, crude worksheet with all these arbitrary things that assign points to what makes a pistol or rifle, which that doesn't come from the law. That just comes from your minds and your ability to come up with some type of a workaround. Now, to be fair, okay, to be maybe a little bit fair, you know, in order to know what something is, you have to define what something is. But we have already been working under what the definition of a pistol is the whole time. So did the definition of a pistol back when, let's just say, AR pistols and AK pistols and all of these different things, when they were a thing, right? If the configuration that those guns were in at the time that they were originally produced way back when, or when the first types of those guns started to show up, why wasn't it an issue back then? Right. So it was a pistol back then and it's a pistol now. So you don't get to change what a pistol is if the manufacturers are hook, line, and sinker following the letter of the GCA to the letter, or the, you know, what it says, the definition is, and they are producing a gun that is by definition exactly that.
Correct.
Right. So if the braces were somehow an issue, right? So the ATF right here just admitted that they don't regulate accessories, but they issued a letter way back when saying, hey, all right, yeah, this is cool. This doesn't do anything.
Good to go.
This doesn't change the configuration. This is what it's for, X amount, whatever, right? So in light of that, you're going to tell a company like SB, hey, you can go and make this, and here's the letter saying that it's okay. And then you're going to backpedal after a decade or 12 years worth of these things have been out there and all these different configurations, right? It's not genuine. It's not a genuine response to say, well, this has now become politically indifferent for us. This gives us the ability to flex our muscles as an alphabet agency. And now we can say, well, okay, politically now we don't like this. So therefore we're going to exercise, I don't know, some crazy power that doesn't exist to now make it illegal through some arbitrary means of some crazy weird worksheet. That now imagine this worksheet showing up on the side of the road and you've got some guy that's got a random brace pistol, mm-hmm. and now you've got people on the side of the road, like the cops having a hard enough time already, and it's not even the cops' job to even deal with NFA stuff. So what? Now every time a person gets pulled over on the side of the road and there's some random law enforcement officer that goes, what the heck is this? And doesn't know anything or a lot about guns. Now what? You're going to call the ATF out every other freaking random traffic stop that happens to involve a brace pistol. And then you're going to have to get somebody from the technology branch at one of the field offices to drive no telling how far to go out and go, all right, well, this either passes the worksheet or it doesn't based on X amount of criteria. A, don't have the manpower to do that. B, the political will to the people that actually exist within the confines of the agency isn't there. Now, they may say, well, we're just doing our gerbs, right? But at the end of the day, I guarantee you most of them don't want to deal with that bull crap. I'm going to give them benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to assume that they don't want to deal with that bull crap. All right, now getting back to the $200 tax stamp. So you mean to tell me, okay, that this is a rifle, right, because it has a 12.5-inch barrel and a stock instead of a brace, right? But you mean to tell me that it's legal if I pay a $200 fee, right? But see, that's strange, right? Not just a fee, a tax. So see, that's the strange thing about it.
Like
you're
extortion.
Converting a right into a privilege at that point. So you don't get to say, well, if you pay this $200 frisking fee, which is basically nothing more than a poll tax, right? If you pay this poll tax, pay us the $200, give us a peek under the hood, let us know what you got, what the serial number is, what the configuration is, and then you can have it. Well, is it really illegal?
No. I would say no. And I would say, they're really trying to see, are you going to pay $200 or are you going to risk 10 years in federal prison? So, and you know, it's one of those weird things where because they never raised the price of it, it does have somewhat of a low barrier to entry, which is probably the only reason that it's still around. I think if that tax would have scaled with the economy, there's no way people would be paying that amount of money to own a SBR. Like no matter how much you want a SBR, you're not going to pay that equal scale, because that's like, if you equal it out, that's like
$4,000
Yeah, like $5,000. And I mean, that's
a lot of money.
That's
a lot of money.
More than the gun.
Yeah. I mean, back when all of this stuff started, I mean, $200 was a pile of money. Now, the anti-gunner response to your argument would be, well, it didn't increase with inflation, so you should just be happy it's not $4,000 and it's $200. Mm-hmm. But that also, in turn, even justifies the argument anyway, right? So, $200 was a lot of money when this law was made. Mm-hmm. So it was purposely put in place to disenfranchise the people who couldn't afford to have those types of items, right? So they didn't want you to have that type of stuff. So they priced you out of the equation so that only the super rich could have it. So it was always a class struggle thing.
But do you think by doing that, Eric, they actually created a criminal enterprise because of they priced the average law-abiding citizen out of owning these? They created not a black market, but they created a criminal enterprise of people saying, you know what, I'm just not going to pay it.
I think really what they accomplished in the process was making themselves feel better.
And they provided themselves with a future and jobs, because they said, as long as there's criminals out here not paying the tax, then we'll have people to investigate, we'll have people to go after, we'll have people to string up and make examples of. Because the best example of that I can give is somebody that I knew had the police called on them, and people have a tendency to let their guard down if they feel like they're not doing anything wrong. If they, hey man, I didn't do anything wrong, and the first thing a police officer says, hey, can we take a look inside? And you know, you're not doing anything wrong. You come on in, officer. You take a look around. Nothing out of the ordinary going on here, until they see something. And now they have a duty to report. So by creating this issue, you're literally giving them jobs. They will come in your house, they will find something, and they will report it, and they will arrest you.
Here's the thing too. So, all right, again, going back to the original $200 tax stamp, mm-hmm. this is the issue that I always have had with this thing, right? Like, you look at, I think it was Mayberry versus Madison. I hope I'm not wrong on that, but It was Harper versus Virginia. It was a few Supreme Court cases that ended up determining that poll taxes weren't allowed, that you couldn't tax a right. There could not be a financial barrier of entry required mm-hmm. to exercise a constitutional right. All right. Voting is a constitutional right. You cannot place a financial barrier in place. Like, you can't charge someone a fee to vote. Now, we know that all goes back to Jim Crow era stuff, right? So the reason...
No, it's Jim Eagle.
Well, right.
Yeah, but Jim Eagle stuff.
Right. But so the reason that you even have that in place was that they were trying to disenfranchise the black community and keep them from voting. That was the reason that polling taxes were set up, is so they were hoping that, all right, well, a certain subset of society, be it, let's just see, say either blacks, it was really more geared towards that community. Correct. But it could be anyone who was just, you know, too down on their luck to be able to afford this fee to go vote, right? So they were hoping that by providing a barrier of entry, it would keep a certain group of people from being able to exercise their ability to vote. Oh, yeah,
poor people.
So very much, yeah, anyone who's disenfranchised or poor, white, black, whoever, right?
Mm-hmm. There's plenty of poor everybody.
Right, and they figured that people that were disenfranchised and in those positions in life would vote a certain way politically, and the barrier of entry through the tax was a way to hopefully keep them from voting. Right, to solidify the power that side might have against those type of people. So now where the $200 tax stamp comes in is very much in a similar way. Now, all these years, they've called it a tax. It is a tax. So if the Supreme Court has already said that you can't have polling taxes, why have we not taken this to the Supreme Court and fought the NFA for everything it's worth? Right now, they get through some things on this interstate commerce thing, like the Commerce Clause. So there's some other little legal loopholes that they hide behind, and they say, well, it's justified because of this reason, because we can control interstate commerce and all of this sort of stuff. So just because there's some way that they can hide behind it legally, and or at least the justification that they think that it holds water legally because of some justification that they can find in the Commerce Clause, that's irrelevant. Because at the end of the day, you're still taxing a right. There is a financial barrier placed between your constitutional rights and the tools that you deem appropriate for the defense of your life, right? Like, look, okay, if the very ATF that is supposedly enforcing all of this crap, right, if they're going to kick in your door with an 11.5-inch Daniel Defense or whatever rig that's going to be full auto with a suppressor and flashlight and thermals and a bump helmet with a PVS 31 and combat boots and body armor, level 4 body armor, and they've got freaking dogs with body armor and dogs with night vision, any other random crap, and they pull up with an APC up armor that can take anti-tank rounds or whatever. So you mean they're going to pull up to your house in that rig to tell you that you can't have the very rig that they're pulling up to you with?
Like, not,
you
know, not just that, something as simple as a sawed-off shotgun. They're going to pull up with an APC with a punch on it with, you know, full battle rattle, and they're going to be like, we'll take that sawed-off shotgun, sir.
Right. Yeah, so all of that overwhelming force just because someone, you know, the Weavers, right? You know, Randy had a shotgun a little bit too short. Oh, boy. The world's ending. Oh, and let's just shoot them on sight. I mean, and that's what they did. They shot Mrs. Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Weaver's holding baby.
Oh, yeah. Who was there? Was that David Chipman? That was David Chipman. That was
no,
there.
It wasn't Chipman. I think I it
was.
Believe.
He was at. He was also at. I think he took.
Was it Waco too?
Yeah, he was at both, I believe.
Well, look, I don't want to go down that road because I don't want to get into that because I want to make sure. I don't have those facts in front of me, so I want to make sure we're not, you know.
Fact saying, check us in the comments.
Yeah.
And be nice.
The point is, look, the more overwhelming point that needs to be made beyond a specific ATF agent, like we're not going to go there. Okay. So just put that out of your mind. The point is the power they think they have over people and some of the things that they've done in the past. Like when you look at the ops, like, okay, Waco or Ruby Ridge, or these situations that the ATF has been involved in on these operations, right? Look at the political levers. Again, politicians, right, being put in. I think it was Janet Reno was in charge of the ATF back then, if I'm not mistaken. And, of course, that was during the Clinton administration. Can you look that up?
Yep.
Sorry, but look, the point is, when you get these politicians that are put into these very, very serious positions, right?
Where attorney general.
Who?
Attorney general, Janet Reno.
Okay.
She was the former attorney general, AG, when Clinton.
Okay, when all that was going down, right. But anyway, the point is that when you get these politicians that get their claws into an agency and they go, well, how can we weaponize this against the people that we don't like? That's where the danger becomes. And I think that's where we've really all had an issue with the ATF over these years. Not to mention the very ideas they come up with are not bound in constitutional integrity, and that's the issue that a lot of us have, right? If the ATF were to say, okay, if they were to go back to the DOJ, or I believe it was I think Biden's ATF is the one that put these wheels in motion to move on braces, right? If we were to just take that position and say, all right, I work for the ATF. Let's just take this hypothetical situation. I work for the ATF. And the president writes me a letter or gives me a phone call and says, hey, I don't like this. And elections are coming up. Midterms are coming up. And politically, we need to make sure our base knows that we're tough on guns. And I want you, I don't know what the process is, or I don't even care what the process is. I want you to just go after this and make it public and make it known that we are visibly going to bat on this particular issue. And you know what? We're going to let the court sort it out in the long term. We don't care who we hurt. We don't care who it affects. Hey, and if we can make some extra revenue, let's do it, right? And then if the ATF were in response, if the ATF were to say, well, Mr. President, look, here's the thing. We don't make laws, right? So all we can do is interpret the law. And because, look, I'm not a politician. My job is not to toe some political line. My job is to go, hey, I am in control of a very dangerous agency who has a history of doing some very terrible things. And we're trying to correct that history and trying to right many wrongs in some way or form, or even to somehow justify our existence as an entity. And you know what? Based on the law, Mr. President, I don't have that authority. I don't have the authority to just arbitrarily say, you know, that this is illegal just because you told me you want it to be illegal. You might really, really want it to be illegal, but I don't have the authority to make it illegal. Now, if you want to ask Congress to change the law or pass some law, you're welcome to petition Congress to see if they want to advance some legislation. And if it makes it to your desk, you can sign it. And then now if it's law, then we can have a very different conversation. Now, if there were someone at the ATF that, let's say, could make that type of very human and very integrity-based decision that's not political, that lines up with the Constitution and the law of the land, which the Constitution is, the ultimate law of the land. The wording in the Second Amendment, y'all, is very, very clear and concise. It says everything it means and nothing it doesn't. And it's one of the, you know, when we look at this grocery store list of rights, the Second Amendment is very clear that it, what?
Shall not be infringed.
Shall not be infringed. Right. So that's some pretty clear wording. Now, you can come up with this Commerce Clause. You can come up with all this random crap you think you need to come up with as a workaround to make this $200 tax thing work out in your head. But at the end of the day, you are placing a financial barrier between the rights of the citizens. Okay. And you're disenfranchising a group of people who can't afford to pay $200. Right. Now, if the justification is, well, that $200 could be $4,000, and you rat bastard peons better be lucky that it's not $4,000, that it's only $200. But $200 was a lot of money back then. So that disingenuous situation that existed back in those days when $200 was a lot of money, just because it stayed on the books and that people just turned a blind eye to it and just dealt with it, and because a class of citizens decided, well, maybe I really don't need to own a machine gun because, you know, $200, that's a lot of money. And you know what? Screw it. I'm not going to worry about it. Just because they somehow had a defeated type mentality in terms of how they approached that, you don't get to kick that can down the road because there's a group of people now that want to own this stuff, right? And just because they gave up back then doesn't mean we're giving up now. It doesn't matter if it's $5 or $200 or $5,000, we refuse to accept that as the reality that is before us at this very moment.
Tell us how you really feel, Eric.
It's just, it doesn't hold water.
It isn't,
right?
We are not unjust, those people.
Yeah. We're not those people that were subjected to that $200 tax stamp. Those people were. A lot of those people aren't here anymore. They're gone now, right? You know what I mean? We're not the same people. Right. So we're not going to accept that as your reality. The reality is a large subset of people. Now, getting back to common use, we're going to get on common use here in a second. But I just want it to be articulated that a large subset of people use these for a wide variety of purposes. And those purposes have nothing to do with you.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean? Like, we're going to talk about data and common use in a minute, but I'm sorry. Let me have some.
Questions. Yes, woosah, Eric. So a couple of things I wanted to interject. You know, out of all of the alphabet agencies, the ATF seems to be the only one that has such a hard time interpreting laws. You don't really hear anything out of the other agencies about interpretation. They seem like they have it down to a science. Why? Because it's the law. It's not really open to interpretation. It's like the law is the law. It's either against the law or it's not. Now, I do know there's some discretion that can go, that can be involved. But
the law is the law.
The law is the law. And the ATF seems to be the only one having an issue interpreting that.
It's not that they don't want to interpret it. They just want to interpret it in a way that serves their political masters.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. Every single director that comes in changes the interpretation, and they roll over directors fairly common. Like, I think it's like every time there's a new presidency, they roll over the ATF director.
There was Regina Lombardo, and then I think Marvin was, what's Marv's last name?
Right. There's Marvin Richardson, which is the current. He's the acting director. He's the ATF director. Regina Lombardo.
Yeah.
And then Thomas Brandon. So like every couple of years, they're rolling over these directors, and they are all interpreting the laws differently. So the real question is, why are we okay with letting the Senate and, you know, the president nominate these potential candidates and putting them in office when they really have more control over the public. We should have a say. The public should have a say in who's going to be interpreting the laws, not the senators, not the president.
Congress should have a say. I mean, the laws Congress, pass through Congress.
They do.
By proxy, listen to the people. So if Congress you remove the people's voice from that equation, that's sidestepping the legal process.
Well, so you have to think. Senators, as much as we like to say they represent the people, senators do have a notorious reputation for courting lobbyists, for courting special interest groups. And the ATF happens to govern a set of laws that has a very large special interest group, and they have a very large, you know, anti-establishment group, meaning like the Moms Demand Action guys. So they kind of get lobbied and anti-lobbied at the same time. All I'm saying is that in this particular position, if there is a director that's going to be governing an agency that has to do with the American people, I think the people should have a vote in that, meaning it should go to the public. And just like you're voting for, you know, any other federal elected official, they are a federal employee. They just happen to be a director of a federal agency. Now, if it's the FBI, FBI handles everything within the U.S. You could vote for that too. ATF is a U.S.-based agency. Now, the CIA, they strictly operate, and I say this in air quotes, they strictly operate outside of the U.S. I don't think there's a reason America should vote for that, because we're not privy to the same information. We're not privy to the same intelligence that they're receiving for clandestine operations outside of America.
But the decisions they make do directly affect our lives in some way, shape, or form.
But we will never get that information. That's all classified information. But if you're talking about an agency that is going to be serving justice to the American people, we should have a say in that.
And that justice should be bound in constitutional authority.
Correct.
And from no other, it should be derived from no other source. And that's the issue. Now, when you look at some of the interviews that I've seen of Marvin, you know, that fellow. I mean, he's smart, he's articulate, he seems like he's got an okay head on his shoulders, but man, like when you look at just the level that the talks come from, you can tell they're very, let's just say, pedicured and formed and concisely written, like
they're all canned.
They're like, canned.
Everything is canned.
It's all, you know, talking points that seem to be propagated from some source other than his personal wishes.
I do not recall.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the issue.
I don't recall.
Now, when you look at data, for instance, so when this whole Brace worksheet thing came out and there was the comment section open on braces and everything, The Truth About Guns published an article, which you can actually still find it. It's out there. It's still on their website. If you just look up Iraq Veteran 8888 braces and then look up Truth About Guns on their website or search in their bar, it'll pull it up. And I actually published my letter. Well, I should say they published it for me. Thanks, Dan, and you over there. So they published my letter to the ATF. And the whole idea was that we were wanting to give people who were maybe having a hard time articulating certain points or writing a letter, we wanted to give them a little bit of inspiration to kind of know where I was coming from, like where my thoughts were at the time on, you know, the issues I have with it, which I obviously disagree with going after these things. I mean, we'll get on that in a minute. But in my letter, I did articulate, I'm like, look, you know, there's not even a distinction within, let's just say, the FBI published crime data that even A makes a distinction between braces as a concrete object that is separate from pistols and rifles. Now, if braced firearms of any sort were some sort of crazy pandemic and were causing, you know, being used in a huge crazy majority of crimes or something like that, surely there would be some data point that would articulate, hey, not only were these used, let's just say, in this such a way, but we actually have the data points that prove and point directly to, yes, that these were used in this type of crime by this many people, and here's the result. Here's how many Americans died or how many situations, you know, whatever, right? There'd be some data to correlate or to support that, right? You know, like when we make decisions on things in life, right, they're based on our observations and based on data, or at least most of us, hopefully, base our lives on what we can see and what we can objectively say is, you know, this is the reason we're making this decision. So you don't get to, you know, your argument doesn't hold water when you go, well, we don't really have like some concrete data that backs that up. But what we do have in the data is how many rifles are used in crimes. All right, we have that. Now, I don't know off the top of my head if that data correlates between semi-autos and just regular long guns, but what we do know is that according to FBI-published statistics, that rifles are used in a very, very, very small number of crimes.
Less than hammers.
Oh, gosh, less than hammers. Now, you look at medical malpractice, diabetes, you know,
opioid epidemics.
Yeah, I mean, so there's all these things, right, that kill way more Americans than, let's just say, a rifle. Now, the argument would be, well, Eric, a pistol is a pistol, right? Whatever. Well, at the end of the day, though, handguns make up an entirely different set of data. So you don't get to say, well, a braced handgun is going to be used in a certain proportion of crimes more than one that isn't braced when you don't have the data to point to it. So if the speculation of, let's say, why this worksheet exists is based on a proven and concrete and let's just say data-driven concern, well, then by all means, publish that concern. Let us see the data, right? But they don't have that data. Now, that was one thing I articulated in my letter. The other thing that I articulated in regards to the data, right, was also, you know, we already discussed earlier the $200 tax stamp and how that is certainly an issue because it's disenfranchising a huge group of people. And also, if it wasn't a problem way back when this whole thing was proposed, right, the ATF, not only the ATF, Obama's ATF had every ability, right, when SB first introduced the first, letter that said, hey, we're going to allow this. Well, that was Obama's ATF did that. Right. So, you know what I mean? Like, you don't get to go, well, the political tides have turned and we're just going to politically treat this situation a little bit different because, oh, now it's 10 or 12 years later. Now, in my letter, what I articulated, Matt, is, all right, in that 10 or 12 years that braces have been out there, if they were being used in a higher than normal amount of crimes after 10 or 12 years, A, we would know it. And B, the data would prove it, right? Because eventually the FBI would have to go, well, due to law enforcement input that we're getting, law enforcement are coming to us and saying, well, this particular configuration of firearm is concerning us, and they want us to gather the data based on this specific configuration of firearm, like with this brace or whatever. Oh, well, they're experiencing a higher than normal amount of crime using this particular item, and they want us to collect the data because they want to see, you know, how this looks, right? But that data doesn't exist. So that means that those points were probably never articulated, right? If you were some concerned, or if there was, you know, 150 concerned police chiefs all across all the various large cities where the majority of gun crime occurs, right, Matt?
Correct.
Then wouldn't they go to the FBI and go, hey, look, on the crime statistics, when it comes to guns, are y'all factoring this in? Are y'all considering these? Because they're a problem. That data doesn't exist because that data is not relevant, because the data wasn't worth collecting, because the data wasn't an outcry for that data to exist. Because the problem didn't exist, because braces being some problem isn't a factor in the situation. So, oh, well, a handgun's a handgun. So if the FBI is going to say, well, this many people were killed or injured with handguns, okay, well, then that is what it is. So if the FBI didn't decide to make the distinction between a rifle and a handgun and a braced handgun, then why are we even having this conversation? Why does this exist? It exists because the political tides turned and it became politically important for them to push this issue because of the political environment we exist within, and not because of the constitutional environment, not because of the constitutionality, not because it's right or wrong, not because it's in the best interest of the people, but because there's a political tide that's turning that they want to ride and use that political tide to further their will of infringing on people's rights.
Yep. And I was just kind of looking up those preliminary numbers for the hammers and the blunt objects. So that's what I was kind of doing over here. And you are correct. In 2018, according to the FBI statistics, a whopping 443 people were killed with hammers, clubs, or other blunt objects. 672 people were killed with bare hands, feet, or personal weapons. So a personal weapon to the FBI is anything that's part of your body, like it is attached to you, is your hands or your feet. And then a humongous 297 were killed by any rifle. So if you put together the total deaths from 2018 FBI statistics, hands and feet and hammers make up almost three times what people but killed by rifles, any rifle.
So, point made.
Yeah. I mean, it's
drop
it's
the mic. Yeah, arrest my case.
Dead,
I mean, like,
dead horse. Yep.
So it doesn't hold constitutional water. It doesn't hold the water of reality and facts and statistics and data. And I think the average person at large on the street that owns, let's just say, any random gun, be it a rifle, shotgun, pistol, whatever configuration, be it a SBR, be it a whatever it might be, okay, I don't think the average person at large gives two craps about what is going on here. And I think your average gun owner sees this as a political grandstanding, as a political ploy, and as a means of solidifying a very, very biased and nonpartisan application of force to the people in a very unjustified and unconstitutional way.
And to follow up on that, it actually dropped from 2017, 2018. It was 400 in 2017 killed with rifles. It dropped to 297.
And how many of those were law enforcement?
That's the thing. It doesn't say.
Right? So all of this, of the shooting data that they put out in terms of the FBI crime statistics, it includes suicides.
Yep. Self-inflicted.
And it also includes law enforcement shootings.
Yep. It includes justified.
Yeah. How many no-knock raids are people going and getting shot in, and then they go, well, that's a death with a gun. We're going to add it to the crime statistics. Well, you know, you're not fooling anybody. If you have to dig that deep to get the numbers that you think you need to have to justify some form of action related to going after a given type of firearm, well, if that's the way you got to do it, then you ain't really got much of a leg to stand on.
Yep.
And because the statistics are what they are, and people murder people where they do and when they do, right? We know where these crimes happen. We know the perpetuators of those crimes. We know what tools they most commonly use, but those are very localized and very, very, very localized situations, right? Mm-hmm. You can't apply a blanket statement where we go, well, we're just going to treat this under this very, very, very strict situation, and then go, well, we're not going to get to the root causes of how people actually die with firearms. If you want to get to the root causes of that situation, it definitely ain't got nothing to do with my braced pistol.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sorry, but it doesn't.
And also, if you think about it, so not to take away from the conversation we're having about the government, you know, demanding an extortion fee for a tax stamp. So let's take another look at it as maybe there is also some form of elitism within the gun community about people that have tax stamps being gatekeepers. Because there are opportunities and there are instances where you'll go to the gun range and you pull out your weapon and you have a can on it. And the first thing that happens is either the RSO or the guy behind the counter, like you see him kind of making a beeline to you. He's like, hey, you have your paperwork? They want to make sure that you legally have that before you can shoot it at their range. But the thing is, why does it matter? It's not like they're going to get in trouble you are. But for some reason, they take it upon themselves to kind of be that arbiter of justice on behalf of the ATF. And I'm like, why are you even doing this? So
I think, Matt, that the justification is even more sinister than that. I think that there are quite a few people within the gun community that view NFA as something that is sort of their special place that they can exist in because they have more money than you. And I know that this is a hard conversation to have. And look, you got to have the hard talks, guys. I know this isn't easy. Look, I know that there's a lot of people that, you know, back in the 80s, they bought a ton of different machine guns and they got into them for really ridiculous great money. And of course, you know, yeah, $200 was $200 in terms of a tax stamp, but the machine guns were more affordable back before, you know, the ban occurred on, you know, manufacturing new machine guns and everything like that. And there's a large subset of people in this country that own multi-million dollar collections of machine guns that are worth millions of dollars that they probably don't want to see NFA go away. They don't want to see the tax stamps and the prohibition on creating new machine guns removed because that would make their collections go down in value. My response to someone that feels that way would be this. Look, guys, there's only so many Maxim machine guns and Vickers and MG42s and MG34s and M60s and Browning 1919s and Browning M2 machine guns and any number of random, like, let's just say heritage belt feds. All right. They ain't making them things anymore. Okay. So they're always going to be collectible. Like all the belt fed stuff, all the real cool stuff. They're always going to be collectible. They're always going to have intrinsic value. They will hold their value, right? I think a lot of people are worried that, oh, my gun collection won't be worth anything anymore if NFA goes away. So you know what? I'm not going to openly say that I feel that way, but I'm also going to not do anything on the front of advocating for people being able to produce new machine guns again. So I'm just going to sit down and shut up and just be happy I've got what I've got. And I've got what I have when I got it. And you know what? It's worth a lot of money now. And screw it. It is what it is. It's just, it's a result of the times. It's not my fault that the laws are what they are, right? It's not my fault. No. I just simply lived through this situation and happened to come out in a good situation. So see, honestly, the folks that got into a bunch of machine guns in the 80s might even very well be the same type of people that back in the 30s when the NFA was a thing were like, well, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of people that can't afford this $200 fee to buy a Thompson, but who cares? I'm rich. Mm-hmm. Why do I care? $200 is not a lot of money to me. I'm worried about crime. I'm worried about all these people. And you know what? Yeah, there's some regulatory barrier, but you know what? Who cares? I'm wealthy. I can afford this tax stamp. I don't care about if poor people can have a machine gun or not. So see, there is an elitism that exists there. And that elitism, it drips over into the alphabet agencies. It drips over into the law enforcement, right? It drips over into the lawmaking process, into the, you know, people obtain this power, Matt, and they go, well, I can wield this power. This isn't just a sign on the door outside of my office. Like I can actually weaponize my office to empower myself more. And why do the people at the ATF care how they arbitrarily apply some rule to someone that might hurt someone who might get their door kicked in and decide that this is the best tool for the job, right? Which they have every right to decide that that's the best tool for the job, right? They don't have any emotional or personal connection to the decisions that they make that affect people because they have a whole armory of machine guns. That's right. A whole armory of APCs and guys with armor and a whole group of guys with badges that they can just weaponize to go out and do whatever they want. Now, the end feeling that a guy on the street might have, let's say, yeah, I'm not going to doubt that there's not ATF agents out there that have a bit of a conscience and they go, man, like this doesn't feel right or, you know, this is screwed up. Like, why can't this just be, you know, constitutionally bound and let's just all be on the level here? Yeah, there's probably some people that feel that way, but they're probably really, really, really outnumbered and outclassed by the bureaucrats that are put into the organizations. So, you know.
So, two things. That's what I'm concerned about. I am concerned about people just doing their jobs. And a good example of that is what's going on in Ottawa right now with the police confiscating all the gas from the honking, the trucker convoy. So now the police are actually collecting and stopping the flow of fuel to the truckers. These are citizens. Imagine you're a citizen and you're trying to take your gas that you bought and give it to somebody else. And the police are saying, no. and they confiscate your property because why? It's their job. And that's what it comes down to. In the end, they will do their job.
And because the political tide supports
correct. Now, secondly, as far as the NFA, the guys that are worried about their collections, that is a huge part of it because they feel and they think they're going to lose their nut. Like, that's it. But nothing could be farther from the truth. The price of machine guns is not going to be... It's not going to go down because of the law. It's still a barrier to entry. Do you think Daniel Defense is all of a sudden, if they abolish the NFA, is going to say, well, we're just going to sell these full auto Mark 18s for the same price that we sell our semi-auto Mark 18s?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I don't think so. I don't think so, man.
Because, all right, maybe a few more parts, a little. Okay, so look, on the time front of an AR, right? Okay, sure. Right, there's an extra hole you got to drill. There's a pocket's got to be cut if the lowers aren't already made as a low shelf, right? And there's a few more parts, but it's so cheap that they could maybe raise the price $100, right? They don't have to raise it a lot. If the NFA went away, all the guns would be machine guns.
I would like
why,
to.
Why have
that?
A semi if it could be a machine gun?
Because we're still in a capitalist society, and I like to believe that. But as you know, as a business owner, as someone that you know is invested in the capitalistic nature of America, it doesn't make sense business wise for any company, especially a company the size of some of these arms manufacturers.
Right, but we certainly aren't going to get to know. If no, the NFA doesn't go away.
And then that also is the lines of like people say, well, do you want people to own rocket launchers? A rocket launcher isn't going to be $2,000. I mean, anybody that's selling an AT-4 or an RPG-7, you're probably going to be in it for 10 grand. I mean, that's the barrier. The barrier to entry is not paying. Eric, you've already said it before. You can buy these things. If you go through the proper procedures and you pay the extortion money to the government, you can own a RPG-7. You can own grenades. You can own 40mm grenades. You can own
a tank.
You can own whatever you want if you pay. So what justification do they have for removing the NFA? The companies will still charge you the same money. The barrier to entry is no longer paying the government. The barrier to entry is now paying the company. So the company is just saying, well, sure, we'll sell it to you for 10 grand. And if you have the money, then buy it.
Right. They're going to cost what they're going to cost.
They're going to cost what they're going to cost.
Supply and demand are going to even out in the way that they're going to even out. If the NFA went away tomorrow and all of these companies out here, they're making all kind of random stuff, said, all right, look, we're going to offer full auto versions again of everything we make, right? And of course, there'd be some R&D process they'd go through to maybe, you know, redesign some of their famous designs to be machine guns or whatever. All right. But then those would be out on the market again. And let's say that, for instance, the demand for those items obviously would be so crazy high for a very long time that they would be extremely difficult to get for a long time. And of course, the price is going to be high because the demand would be crazy. And it would take the gun industry a considerable amount of time to catch up with that demand.
Think of how much it would take
ammo. And until that demand is met, the prices are going to be a little silly because that's just how people do. They self-regulate. They go, well, you know what? I'm willing to pay a considerable amount more than what I know this product's worth, but because I just have to have it now. And that would be the case for a long time. And it's not like the people with a Maxim are going to go, well, my $150,000 Maxim is now worth $1,000.
No.
No one's making a Maxim anymore.
Yeah, that's a museum
piece,
man.
Still a rare, historical, valuable machine gun.
That works.
All we can really hope here is that, you know, cooler heads will prevail. And the whole gist of this particular podcast is like, we can only speculate on what is actually going to happen with this worksheet and with the brace situation. We have until August. You know, this is still pretty early in the year. We're several months out from really knowing what exactly they're going to say. Everything that we've sort of discussed has been sort of steeped in speculation. So I wanted you to understand that's our opinion. And we've articulated a few things. I didn't really get to go into common use, and I know we did discuss statistics, which I feel is certainly a much more important thing to consider, because really the statistics and facts and everything are where the rubber meets the road in order to make a very objective and fair assertion of what your opinion is going to be on the matter. I'll just end the podcast by mentioning very quickly, Matt, about common use, right? All right. When the NFA, all right, we're talking about handguns here. This worksheet talks about handguns. All right. There is a legal definition for what a handgun is. Okay. What I would ask you to consider, all right, is when the NFA was originally adopted.
Handgun.
Right. When the NFA was originally adopted, all right, how many people owned handguns? How many guns were there? And how many people owned handguns? And then how many people own handguns now, regardless of the configuration, right? The worksheet itself even says that the ATF does not form opinions on, doesn't regulate devices and accessories. They regulate
weapons,
firearms. Yeah. They regulate the completed configuration. So ask yourself, if we're looking at this on a basis of common use, how much more common are handguns now than when the NFA was originally even adopted in the first place? How many gun owners were there then versus now? How many handguns were there then versus now? Right? How many handguns are being purchased now in comparison to the amount of rifles and shotguns and other configurations that are being sold? So if we're looking at this under the basis of common use, handguns are probably one of the most common used firearms there is.
For sure.
In the America right now, especially when you look at all the new gun owners, what are they buying? They're buying handguns.
Well, we better go after those assault rifles and, you know, all those machine guns and braces and just, I know you're hitting on common use. I know we had this MDR sitting up here, and I think we had that as an example of, you know, just how...
the length.
Overall length, but also just changes in technology and changes in weapons.
Bring it
systems.
Over here. Ah. All right. So this is a Desert Tech MDR. It's a bullpup. So it has a 16-inch barrel.
Look all at right. the size of that thing, man.
Now look, compact. This is a 12.5-inch SBR. Well, it's a machine gun, but for the purposes of the argument of the particular podcast we're doing, let's pose this, okay? A 12.5-inch barrel, 16-inch barrel. Now, in close range, like personal defense situations, you know, you're still going to get a crap ton of energy out of a 12.5, and you can still get some good work done with a shorter configuration. But, all right, well, short. Okay, well, the bullpup is shorter.
Longer barrel.
All right.
Overall length is shorter.
The bullpup transfers as a rifle. So any 18-year-old, you know, some stores have stupid policies that you got to be 21 to buy this kind of stuff. But an 18-year-old can buy this rig. It's a non-NFA. It's a Title I gun that transfers right over the counter. And you get full velocity out of M855, M855A1, what have you. Mm-hmm. In a package that is more compact than a short M4 anyway.
Yep. And even if you could put that up against a weapon with a brace, and the only reason it would be shorter is if it was a folding brace. But we've compared that next to a braced pistol, and it's the same overall length almost.
So the point is this is not an argument, right? This is not an argument about technology. This is not an argument about capabilities of what guns can do. And what type of configurations can somehow skirt some random perceived loophole that isn't really a thing, right? I mean, look how long the Steyr AUG's been out.
Yep.
Since the 70s.
Yeah, 70s.
Right? So this isn't like there's not technologies out there that blend the two in some way and that they haven't been known about for a long time and that they weren't known about long before the brace thing ever became a thought in someone's mind. This is merely a political tide that is turning, and they see an opportunity to ride the wave and infringe on more people without going through the legislative process. And that's the bottom line of what we see in front of us. We have to oppose it at every step because the Second Amendment is the prohibition of our time. This NFA crap they keep talking about and trying to make more firearms subject to NFA is merely the prohibition of our time. We have to resist it at every turn. We can't allow these people to just arbitrarily weaponize the government against honest, hardworking, average people.
Peacefully.
Right.
Just disclaimer, peacefully.
Yeah. What else you got?
No, dude, I think that was great. We had a great conversation about just in general with the NFA and the BS. I was going to use some other flavorful language, but other BS and just the intricacies of how they interpret certain laws. And I think we did a pretty good job of wrapping that up so people could, at a high level, if you listen to the whole podcast and it's like an hour of your time, I think that you'll leave this podcast having a better understanding of how people in the industry feel, as well as people in the general public. Because yes, Eric works extensively in the industry. I dabble in the industry when I come down and hang out. But we both live that lifestyle of carrying weapons all the time, of making sure that you're armed. And, you know, I don't want to be one step closer to federal prison just because I make a mistake on a worksheet. You know, and I don't want to leave. Yeah. I don't want to leave that up to the police officer that is going to be pulling me over for a traffic citation to try to interpret that either.
And imagine being the person at large who just went into a gun shop 5 or 6 years ago and bought a braced handgun because the guy behind the counter said, "Yeah, everything's cool. It's legal. Yep. It's totally a thing now." And in good faith, bought that gun and just went about your business, and say that you don't have your ear to the ground on this stuff and you don't pay attention to it. And then you just arbitrarily get pulled over. Mm-hmm. And then now all of a sudden you're in hot water and you were told on good faith that, hey, this is fine. I just think that our society demands a more honorable approach to, you know, how we look at situations in that. I think we deserve better than that. And I think society should demand a more fair and equitable way of approaching lawmaking than just arbitrarily weaponizing it against people. It's unfair and it's unconstitutional and it's not bound in good faith. And that's the issue I have with it.
Agreed.
Guys, have a good one. Thank you so much for tuning into LOP. I hope you all have a great week. Make sure you give us a good thumbs up. Make sure you subscribe to our channel, IraqVeteran8888. Click that notification bell so you get all of our videos. Thank you so much. I know this is long form. I'm going to be doing a lot more short form stuff, so stay tuned for that. Have yourselves a great week. Go in liberty, be free, be happy, and it'll all get better, I promise.
Bye, machine guns.
Have yourselves a good one.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Life, Liberty, and Pursuit. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are found. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. You can support us over on Ballistic Inc. by picking yourself up some merch. And remember, guys, dangerous freedom. Have a good one.